May 4th, 1996. Sitka, Alaska. While walking home from her sister's house after celebrating her 17th birthday, Jessica Bagan is attacked on a bicycle path. Her body is soon found in a wooded area, where she has been sexually assaulted and asphyxiated to death. 11 days later, a suspect named Richard Bingham turns himself into the police, and after making a videotape confession, he is charged with Jessica's murder. However, none of the physical evidence matches Bingham, and it becomes apparent that his confession was coerced by investigators. When Bingham goes on trial, the jury finds him not guilty, and Jessica Bagan's real killer is never found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we've got a pretty controversial case to cover today. The 1996 murder of 17-year-old Jessica Bagan. This story was originally requested to me by one of our previous Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest winners, Loquin Britton, and I had never heard of this case before. Once I did some quick Googling, many of the matches I got were websites and articles which referenced this case when discussing the topic of false confessions. Shortly after Jessica's murder, police charged a suspect named Richard Bingham after he turned himself in and confessed to the murder, so at first, this seemed like a pretty cut-and-dried case. However, no other evidence linked Bingham to the crime, and it soon became apparent that he only made a videotaped confession after police used some coercive techniques during his interrogation. In most cases, this type of thing would lead to a wrongful conviction, but Bingham's defense team did such an effective job at dismantling the case against him that he was acquitted at trial. Unfortunately, this situation ensured that Jessica's real killer pretty much slipped through the cracks, and after 2 decades, the investigation has yet to uncover any strong alternate suspects. So on this episode, we're going to explore how things went horribly wrong in this case, and why it has hit a complete standstill. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the murder of Jessica Bagan. Our story begins in 1996 in Sitka, Alaska, a consolidated city/borough located on the west side of Baranof Island, which is only accessible via boat and plane. When it comes to land area, Sitka is considered the largest city/borough in the United States, but its actual population is just under 9,000 people. Sitka is best known as the location of the transfer ceremony for the Alaska Purchase when the U.S. acquired Alaska from Russia in 1867. Our central figure in this story is a local teenage girl named Jessica Irene Bagan, who lives with her parents, George and Vicky Bagan, and has 3 sisters. Ever since childhood, Jessica loved going on fishing expeditions with her family and cooking up the fish they caught, so she was considering a career in the cooking field. The evening of Friday, May the 3rd, was Jessica's 17th birthday, so she and some of her friends decided to celebrate at the home of Jessica's older sister Amanda, who lived at the Arrowhead Trailer Court on Sawmill Creek Road. At approximately 1:30 a.m. on May 4th, Jessica left on her own to walk back to her family's home on Barlow Street, 1 mile away, but unfortunately, she never made it. When Jessica did not arrive, her family eventually called the Sitka Police Department to report her missing, and a search was conducted of the area. At around 3 a.m. on May 6th, Jessica's nude body would be discovered in a wooded area 50 yards away from the Sawmill Creek Road bicycle path. She had been sexually assaulted, and dirt was forcefully shoved into her mouth, which blocked her air passages. The killer had attempted to bury Jessica's body in a shallow grave underneath some leaves, dirt, and brush. The cause of death was determined to be asphyxiation, but while bones in Jessica's throat were crushed, it was impossible to conclusively determine whether she had been strangled to death or if she had fatally choked on the dirt in her mouth. She also had black eyes to indicate she had been struck with a blunt object. Jessica's clothing was found scattered nearby, and her blouse had traces of blood on it, which did not match her and likely belonged to the perpetrator. When she left her sister's home, Jessica had been carrying a 5x7-inch green drawstring pouch, which contained a handmade teakwood marijuana pipe decorated with inlaid brass or copper stars, but these items were never recovered. This particular bike path was known for being frequented by students from nearby Sheldon Jackson College. The college owned the wooded area where Jessica's body was found, and it was located in between the bike path and the boardwalk which connected the campus to Sawmill Creek Road. Students from one of the campus's dormitories would recall hearing what sounded like a scream around the approximate time period Jessica was murdered. The week following Jessica's murder, around 1,500 people participated in a memorial walk for her, which started at Sitka National Historical Park and ended on the Sawmill Creek Road footbridge near where her body was found. The crime put the entire community on edge, and the Sitka police chief was forced to call a town meeting to address concerns about public safety. However, there would soon be a very unexpected development. Shortly after 5:30 a.m. on the morning of May 15th, Richard Bingham, a 34-year-old janitor at Sheldon Jackson College, walked into the Sitka police station and said, quote, "I've got to get this off my chest." Bingham told police he had been having flashbacks in which he saw himself burying something near Indian River before washing his hands in the river. Since the river was in close proximity to Jessica Baggin's murder scene, Bingham wondered if there might be a connection. 2 days before the crime took place, he claimed he remembered seeing Jessica walking across the campus of Sheldon Jackson College in a black dress. On the evening of May 3rd, Bingham had been out partying and became extremely intoxicated by consuming between 8 to 12 beers and abusing the prescription drug hydrocodone. He recalled going to see his brother at Cole's Trailer Court sometime after midnight, which would have involved walking down the Sawmill Creek Road bike path. The day before he turned himself into the police, one of Bingham's friends apparently put the idea into his head that he could have crossed paths with Jessica on the bike path and killed her, but did not remember because of an alcoholic blackout. Bingham genuinely feared that he may have been responsible for the murder and wasn't sure if he could live with himself. Bingham was interrogated by police, who even took him to the bike path in hopes of jogging his memory. They eventually videotaped him, making a full confession to the rape and murder of Jessica Baggin. By 5 p.m. that same day, police issued a news release that Bingham had been arrested and charged with the crime. At the time, Bingham was living on a 21-foot boat in Thompson Harbor, which was seized and subsequently searched by police. Dwayne McConnell, an assistant district attorney from Juneau, was brought in to prosecute the case, and a week and a half after his arrest, Bingham was indicted by a grand jury on one count of murder in the first degree, two counts of sexual assault in the first degree, and one count of tampering with physical evidence. If convicted of all charges, Bingham could have faced up to 129 years in prison. But in spite of his confession to police, Bingham entered a not guilty plea and was assigned a public defender named Galen Payne to represent him. Over the course of the next year, Bingham's trial would be postponed multiple times after Payne filed a number of motions in an attempt to get the case against him dismissed. Payne alleged that Dwayne McConnell had rushed the case to the grand jury and pressured them into an indictment before all the evidence against Bingham could be thoroughly explored. McConnell apparently told him that he was, quote-unquote, up against a time limit on this case and needed a decision on the indictment by mid-afternoon. Well, it turned out that virtually none of the physical evidence from the murder scene matched Bingham, and the entire crux of the case against him was his confession, which Payne was now calling into question. she claimed that key parts of Bingham's videotape confession were suppressed from the grand jury because they showed investigators leading him on and influencing Bingham into mentioning key details about the crime which incriminated him. Payne argued that the confession had been coerced and should be ruled inadmissible. Payne's motions to dismiss the case were denied, though she wound up being granted a motion to move the trial out of Sitka, as she believed that the massive pretrial publicity would prevent Bingham from receiving a fair and impartial jury. The trial wound up being moved to Juneau, and finally began in June of 1997. The prosecution argued that while the physical evidence against Bingham wasn't perfect, the details of his confession did match the crime, and a pathologist would testify that Jessica's autopsy revealed injuries which were consistent with what Bingham described. However, Bingham's defense team would poke a number of holes in the confession, arguing that he did not provide any details to the police which were not already public knowledge, and some of the details he did provide were inaccurate. For instance, he said that Jessica was wearing sweats that night, even though she had been wearing a blouse and jeans. Bingham claimed he bit Jessica on the back, but no bite marks were found on her body. And even though Bingham had mentioned rubbing Jessica's face in the dirt while attacking her, he never said anything about forcefully shoving dirt into her mouth. If Bingham provided any details during his interrogation which contradicted the known facts of the case, the police would tell him, quote, "Let's not get hung up on that," and immediately change the subject. But the details Bingham did get right were fed to him beforehand by the detectives. The full unedited videotape of Bingham's confession was shown in court, and Galen Payne argued that it was coerced. When Bingham approached the police, he flat out told them, quote, "I can't remember what happened. I want you guys to help me out. That's why I'm here. It's driving me crazy," end quote. As I mentioned earlier, the previous day, one of Bingham's friends had put the idea into his head that he may have killed Jessica without even remembering it and should confess. Well, this friend testified as a witness for the defense, claiming that he was only joking when he said that. Since Bingham was prone to blacking out when he drank too much, the two friends had been playing a private, quote-unquote, game for years, in which they would look at crimes on the police blotter and joke that Bingham must have done it during one of his alcoholic blackouts. However, since there was a lot of hysteria in the community following Jessica's murder, Bingham genuinely feared that he may have actually killed her. A defense psychologist who performed an evaluation on Bingham testified that he suffered from a personality disorder which manifested itself in paranoia and low self-esteem. He depended on the approval of others for reinforcement and was likely to be deferential to authority figures. In other words, he fit the profile of someone who might falsely confess to the police. During Bingham's interrogation, the police said, quote, "The family wants some closure on this, and I think you need some closure. You have to do the right thing." When Bingham said he had recently been suffering from anxiety attacks, he was told they were a quote-unquote message from God and that he needed a clean slate. The detectives even tried to put the idea into Bingham's head that Jessica's death might not necessarily have been a murder, but an accident. So not only was Bingham's confession being called into question, but his defense also presented a lot of evidence which pointed away from him being the perpetrator, including a fairly solid alibi. After he spent the evening of May 3rd getting heavily intoxicated at a friend's house, Bingham had stated that he crossed paths with Jessica on the bike path while going to search for his brother at Cole's trailer court. While Bingham did visit the trailer court that night, this actually occurred around midnight, an hour and a half before Jessica even left her sister's house to walk home. Multiple witnesses, including Bingham's brother, testified that he went back to his boat on Thompson Harbor to continue drinking and could corroborate that he was there between 12:30 and 3:30 a.m. Bingham's brother claimed that he went to sleep on the boat, and that when he woke up later that morning, Bingham was still there, wearing the exact same clothes, and showing no signs of having gotten into a violent struggle. But most importantly, there was no physical evidence linking Bingham to the murder scene. 5 reddish-blonde pubic hairs were found there, and while DNA testing on them was inconclusive, they did not match Bingham or Jessica, and instead pointed towards an unknown third party. A pack of cigarettes were found near Jessica's body containing a fingerprint, which also did not match Bingham. In addition, DNA testing excluded Bingham as the source of the blood found on Jessica's blouse, as well as semen stains found on her panties. However, DNA would match the semen to Jessica's former boyfriend, Travis Ray, who was able to explain this by testifying that he had sex with her on May 2nd, a day and a half before the murder. It turned out that investigators did not check Travis's alibi on the night of the crime, because he was never considered a serious suspect, but it's worth noting that Travis was excluded as being the source of the 5 pubic hairs found at the scene. Well, the case finally went to the jury on June 20th, and after deliberating for less than 2 hours, they found Bingham not guilty on all charges and acquitted him. Some of the jurors later revealed that when they first went to the jury room, their original vote was 11-1 in favor of not guilty, and it didn't take long to sway the lone holdout juror into a unanimous verdict. The Bagan family were surprised that the jury decided to acquit Bingham after such a short period of deliberation and publicly expressed their belief that they still thought Bingham was guilty. Bingham feared that his personal safety would be in jeopardy if he returned to Sitka, so upon his release from jail, he immediately moved to another state. The acquittal brought the investigation into Jessica's murder back to square one, as the Sitka police said they had no other alternate suspects. In spite of this, however, they still considered the case to be open, and said they were willing to explore other leads. A few years after the trial, Jessica's father, George Bagan, even paid a pair of private investigators from New York and California to come to Sitka and perform a new investigation, but unfortunately, they failed to make much progress. So after 2 decades, there have been no other major developments in the case, and Jessica Bagan's killer remains unidentified. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So it seems that outside of Alaska, this is not a particularly well-known murder case. Like I mentioned in the intro, if you do a Google search, most of the matches you'll get are articles or websites which cite this case as an example of when false confessions occur. Otherwise, it doesn't sound like Jessica's murder or Richard Bingham's trial got much coverage at all outside of Sitka's local newspaper, the Daily Sitka Sentinel. But it was a pretty big story there, and the crime clearly had a devastating effect on the community. If you go to newspapers.com and delve into the Daily Sitka Sentinel's archive, you'll find a birthday notice for Jessica in their May 3rd, 1996 edition. It's creepy to think this would be Jessica's last day alive, and that her name would dominate that paper's headlines for the next year because of her murder. Even though Sitka is not a large community, it's not immune to brutal crimes, as the town became the subject of its own episode of the popular podcast Small Town Murder, which covered the 1988 disappearance of Scott Colville. That case went unsolved for nearly 22 years, until his wife, Jane Reth, was charged with shooting him and dismembering his body with an axe before disposing of his remains. Just last year, a Sitka man named Reuben Yerkes went to prison for the shooting death of his girlfriend, Allie Clayton. Like Richard Bingham, Yerkes just flat-out walked into the Sitka police station and confessed to the murder. But here's an odd coincidence. Yerkes did this at 3 a.m. on May 6, 2017, and Jessica Bagan's body was discovered at approximately 3 a.m. on May 6th, exactly 21 years earlier. Of course, the big difference in these two cases is that Reuben Yerkes actually did it, whereas Richard Bingham turned himself in for a murder he did not commit. Now, I'm sure most people are aware that a number of wrongful convictions which have taken place were the result of false confessions. In many of these cases, the only real evidence against the defendant was their confession, and even though a lot of other evidence pointed away from them, they still wound up being convicted at trial. I think the issue is that while the general public is more aware about the prevalence of false confessions today, a lot of people still have trouble comprehending the idea that an innocent person would confess to a crime they didn't commit. Thankfully, that did not happen in this particular case, because in spite of Richard Bingham's confession, his defense team presented an overwhelming amount of evidence to support his innocence, and it obviously made an impression on the jury. The fact that they voted on an acquittal after deliberating for less than 2 hours shows just how flawed the state's case really was. This doesn't sound like an example where a jury thought the defendant might be guilty, but did not feel the prosecution proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt. They simply believed that Bingham did not do it. Interestingly enough, during jury selection, one of the potential jurors stated that his own daughter had been violently murdered and he wasn't sure he could remain unbiased. Yet he still got selected because he claimed he had first-hand knowledge of his father-in-law experiencing alcoholic blackouts. The defense figured he would be open to the idea that Bingham experienced the same thing, and sure enough, he was able to put aside any personal feelings he might have had and voted not guilty. While an acquittal does not necessarily mean that a defendant was not guilty of the crime, I think it's pretty safe to say the jury reached the correct verdict here. None of the physical evidence matched Bingham, he seemed to have a pretty solid alibi, and a number of details in his so-called confession were inaccurate. Now, I certainly cannot fault the police for believing Bingham was the killer, since he approached them and genuinely seemed to think he might have done it. The Sitka police were under a tremendous amount of pressure to solve this case. Just 2 days beforehand, their police chief held a town meeting where citizens expressed their concern that Sitka was being tainted by hysteria and rumors that an unknown serial predator was committing sexual assaults in Sitka National Historical Park, and that the police knew about it and were intentionally withholding this information from the public. So I'm sure investigators breathed a huge sigh of relief when it appeared that the killer was walking into their station to turn himself in and confess. But the problem, of course, is that Bingham did not disclose any specific details about the crime which weren't already public knowledge, and when he started providing details which contradicted the facts, the police should have taken this as a major red flag. It's pretty much inevitable that whenever a crime garners a lot of coverage in the media, people are going to attempt to falsely confess for the attention. It's the police's job to question these folks in a way which allows them to determine whether or not they might be lying, and one of their strategies is to withhold certain details about the crime from the public, which only the perpetrator would know. I'm willing to believe that in many high-profile cases, the police deal with a bunch of false confessions we don't even hear about because the confessor is immediately exposed as a liar and ruled out as a suspect. But in this case, I think the investigators' desire to solve the case got the better of them, which is why they led Bingham on and fed him details during his interrogation. In the end, they were able to coerce him into giving a videotaped confession which was close enough to the facts that they could finally charge him. I think it's no accident that Assistant District Attorney Dwayne McConnell pressured the grand jury into indicting Bingham as quickly as possible, as he was probably worried about the case falling apart if people delved into the evidence more closely. And that, to me, is the major problem. I know that honest mistakes will happen, and innocent people will sometimes be charged with a crime they didn't commit, but when it becomes apparent that the people in power know or suspect they got the wrong person, and still move forward with the case anyway because they just want to get it solved, that's crossing some major ethical boundaries. Now, the thing with Bingham is that when he originally turned himself in, he thought there was a good chance he really did kill Jessica, but we later learned this was the result of alcoholic blackouts, which were a common occurrence for him. In a number of wrongful conviction cases involving false confessions, the investigators were able to convince the defendant that they had committed the crime, but did not remember it because they blacked out or completely blocked the incident from their memory. They subsequently confessed, but once all the facts came in, and the evidence showed they likely weren't the killer, they had already been charged with the crime, and recanting their confession didn't make any difference. This type of thing has happened to people who did not even have a history of blackouts like Bingham did. I think that when Bingham went to the police, he was hoping they would be able to present him with evidence which proved he couldn't have murdered Jessica, giving him a clear conscience. Of course, that's what they should have done, but instead, they did the exact opposite and railroaded him. I have to give major kudos to Bingham's attorney, Galen Payne, who did a phenomenal job of representing him and tearing apart the state's case, especially when you consider that she was a public defender and not some high-priced lawyer. I know that defense attorneys often have to represent guilty people, but in cases like this, where the defendant is legitimately innocent, you see how important they truly are. Following the trial, the judge stated that Galen Payne delivered the most outstanding dissection of a defendant's confession that he had seen during his 25 years on the bench. After Bingham was acquitted, Payne even took the step of embracing Jessica Baggins' mother, Vicky, in the courtroom. Even though Payne genuinely believed she had helped an innocent man go free, she still felt immense empathy for the pain the Baggins family was forced to endure. I know the family's initial reaction following the verdict was that Bingham was still guilty, but since Jessica's father eventually paid for private investigators to look into the murder, It's possible they no longer feel that way and came to believe someone else was responsible. As for Bingham, I know he moved out of Alaska following the trial because of concerns about his safety, but I have no idea where he is today. He obviously had a lot of personal issues, which is how he became embroiled in this case to begin with, but I hope he was able to get his life back in order and find some peace. To their credit, even after Bingham was acquitted, the Sitka Police Department still kept the investigation into Jessica's murder open. In cases like this, it's common for the police to hold the mentality, well, we got the right man, but the jury set him free, so what else can we do? But here, they were actually willing to explore other leads and acknowledge the possibility that the real killer was still out there. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like they've made much progress at finding alternate suspects, so we're going to explore this angle for the rest of the episode. Unfortunately, there really isn't too much analysis that can be done about figuring out who the real perpetrator was, because there isn't much to work with, but I am intrigued by the DNA results from the semen stains found on Jessica's panties. We know it didn't match Bingham, but it did match Jessica's former boyfriend, Travis Ray. Now, if you heard the episode I released 2 years ago about the murder of Holly Staker, you'll know that one of the most egregious tactics used in wrongful conviction cases occurs whenever a murder victim is raped and the DNA from the semen samples does not match the person who has been charged with the crime. But to explain this away, the state tries to push forward the theory that the victim had consensual sex with another individual shortly before they were murdered, so the DNA results mean nothing and the accused is still guilty. Well, most of the time, that assertion is completely ridiculous, but in this case, there is actually some truth to it, since Travis Ray testified that he had sex with Jessica on May 2nd, a day and a half before she was killed. On the surface, that does make sense, but I still have some questions. There's not much information out there about Travis, but I find it interesting that the media coverage referred to him as Jessica's quote-unquote ex-boyfriend. Now, this is a year after Jessica's death, so technically that's true, but when they use the phrase ex-boyfriend, did they mean that Jessica and Travis were already broken up before she was killed? If that's the case, then it's weird they would be having consensual sex together, and if their relationship ended badly, this might give Travis a potential motive. During the trial, the investigators admitted that they never looked into Travis's alibi on the night of the murder, especially after Bingham was charged with the crime. And maybe it's just me, but since Jessica and Travis supposedly had sex on May 2nd, does it strike anyone else as strange that Jessica would be wearing the same pair of panties the following day without having washed them? All that being said, the pubic hairs which were found at the murder scene did not belong to Travis, making it unlikely he committed the crime. I'm not sure if they ever tested Travis's DNA against the unidentified blood found on Jessica's blouse, but I'd like to think that after Bingham's acquittal, the police performed a more thorough investigation into Travis and were able to rule him out as a suspect. Of course, there is something about the crime which seems awfully personal, as not only was Jessica raped and murdered, but dirt was shoved into her mouth to block her air passage. Even though this may have been done in an attempt to stop her from screaming, it's still an incredibly sadistic thing to do. When Bingham was charged with the murder, a lot was made of his claim that he had seen Jessica walking across the campus of Sheldon Jackson College 2 days earlier while wearing a black dress. This was used to push forward the theory that he had developed a fixation with her, which escalated into violence. However, at Bingham's trial, the defense called upon other witnesses from the college to testify they had also remembered seeing Jessica walk across the campus in a black dress on that particular day. Jessica had recently purchased the outfit, which resembled a prom dress, for an upcoming birthday dinner with her cousins, and even though none of these witnesses actually knew Jessica, the outfit was distinctive enough that they could still recall seeing her. So it's possible that someone else from the college besides Bingham might have seen Jessica in the black dress that day and developed their own fixation on her. Since the bike path was adjacent to the campus and used by students all the time, the perpetrator may have used this opportunity to attack her. However, the fact of the matter is that Jessica was walking along this path alone at 1:30 a.m., so this also could have been a completely random crime of opportunity. Not only was this path often used by college students, but it was also used by transients and seasonal workers who lived at a nearby camp. It was very common during the spring and summer seasons for outsiders to arrive in Sitka in order to receive work associated with the local canneries and fishing vessels, so it's entirely possible that an opportunistic predator living at one of these worker camps could have attacked and murdered Jessica. They may have skipped town immediately following the crime, but since Richard Bingham was charged less than 2 weeks later, perhaps the killer remained in Sitka to finish out their seasonal work because they knew someone else was taking the fall. But the fact that no one else has popped up on the radar as a strong alternate suspect these past 2 decades makes me lean towards the idea that the killer was not local and has long since left the area. So without any promising leads, it might seem like solving this case might be a major uphill climb, but the good news is that there's a lot of physical evidence to work with. We have DNA from the blood on Jessica's blouse, as well as the 5 unidentified pubic hairs, and a fingerprint on a pack of cigarettes found near the murder scene, though I'm not sure if it was conclusively established if those cigarettes belonged to the killer. Regardless, you probably know that 2018 was the biggest year ever in regards to cold cases being solved, and a lot of these were made possible when unidentified DNA from the crime scenes was uploaded to genealogy websites like GEDmatch, which allowed investigators to eventually track down the perpetrator. In some of these cases, the killer turned out to be someone who had never shown up on the radar as a suspect before, and otherwise might never have been caught. So there's no reason the same method can't be used to track down Jessica's killer. I would be remiss if I didn't mention one other potentially important piece of evidence, the 5x7-inch green drawstring pouch containing a handmade teakwood marijuana pipe decorated with inlaid brass or copper stars. As you recall, Jessica had been carrying these items at the time she was killed, but they were never found, and it was suspected that the killer kept them as a memento. I'm not sure if the perpetrator would still have these items after more than 2 decades, but if they did, it could potentially help link them to the crime. This is a case where mistakes were definitely made during the investigation and nearly led to an innocent man going to prison, but there's still a chance to make things right and find the real killer and attain justice. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved murder of Jessica Bagan, please contact the Sitka Police Department Crime Line at 907-747-8980. That's 907-747-8980. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've already released some exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in Tiers 2 and 3. Last month, we did an episode titled The Trail Went Hot about the many cold cases which were solved in 2018, and we've got another bonus episode set for release this month. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon, and they are Emily K., Jennifer W., Julia, and Amy P. Thank you all so much for your support. And here's another important announcement. Next month will officially mark the 3-year anniversary of The Trail Went Cold, and per tradition, we are currently holding a poll where you can vote on which case you'd like us to cover on our anniversary episode, which is scheduled to be released on February the 20th. We've selected 10 of our most highly requested cold cases, and if you would like to cast a vote, please visit us on Facebook or Twitter, and you'll find our poll pinned to the top of the page. Voting officially closes this coming Sunday, January the 20th at midnight Eastern Standard Time, so cast your vote while you still can. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.